maybe we ought to say that the issue that Paul deals with in chapter 7, or the issues and related issues that are dealt with in chapter 7, are very, very contemporary issues. And we could mention just briefly some of those. For instance, the question of the place of women in the church is obviously a big problem in deciding whether or not women ought to be ordained. And as I understand it from the news that has come, the Price regime has won in Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and that means, I guess, that it is extremely unlikely that Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is going to reverse its position on the ordination of women, and I'm sure that it's very unlikely that the American Lutheran Church or Lutheran Church in America, is either one of those is going to reverse its position. So, at the present time, that question of the ordination of women is probably the most obvious thing that's going to keep those Lutheran groups apart, and apparently for some time in the future. And so that's a kind of a present-day setting. I think another thing is the whole sexual revolution in which we live that has to do certainly with male and female roles, and that certainly doesn't have to be elaborated on very much, but just to say one thing, and maybe I can say that best by telling you about a course that my wife and I went to at the University of Minnesota, a program in human sexuality, which is offered to, which is required for all medical students at the University of Minnesota, and which is offered to theological students in the Twin City area. And there is some sense in which the theological schools and the medical school cooperate on that, although we think that the cooperation means that they use our name, and what input we have in there is pretty minimal. Anyway, that changes from time to time, but the time that that we attended, it began with, it is a two-day kind of immersion thing in films and conversation. It's a kind of a desensitization type session. The first thing that happened in that program was a slide or a film strip thing called Genesis. And in the first frame, Adam is standing there with no genitalia, just kind of an outlined form, and he says, "Hi, God." And God says in the next frame, "Hi, Adam." And Adam says, "Thanks a lot for making me. I think that's great." And God says, "That's all right. I think nothing of it." He says, "But I'm not finished yet." And Adam says, "Oh, really?" And in the next frame, he stands there with genitalia, and he stands looking down, and he says, "Geez, looks kind of funny." And God says, "Try it, you'll like it." And then in the next frame, he's standing there with this enormous erection and splattering all over the film, and says, "Wow, yippee, yay!" Says, "Boy, thanks God, I'll do anything you say." And God says, "Just one thing, don't use it." And everybody laughs his head off. That's the opener for University of Minnesota program in human sexuality required for all medical students. Now, we've argued against that. Whether that's been changed, I don't know. But the point is that the church is seen as the great repressor, the great institution that says no to human sexuality. And Augustine, of course, is quoted at length, who thought the original sin was transmitted through sexual intercourse. And of course, the Apostle Paul is one of the great culprits who said no to human sexuality. Now, I think that's really serious, and I think that the church cannot remain silent, you know, in that kind of situation. So that's another setting. Another setting that it seems to me points up the significance of this particular passage is that when I was at Luther Seminary some years ago, I heard about, it had already changed a little bit, but I heard about the time not much before when I was there, that when a person became engaged, when a student became engaged, he, and there were no women students at that time, had to go into the president and write that down on a piece of paper, that he was engaged to Matilda Hovneros, and what the date was and address and everything. If that engagement were broken, he was out on his ear. Now, at the present time in the American Lutheran Church, I've heard that 5% of American Lutheran Church pastors are divorced and remarried. That's a big change in a very short time. And so we have ordination of women, we have the revolution in human sexuality, we have the divorce question. That's at least, you know, part of the backdrop for this particular passage. Okay, what about the situation in Corinth, to which Paul wrote? Well, that was pretty complex, too. One thing was that there were these Greek people in the congregation. There were Romans and there were Jews, but there were also Greeks. Talked a lot at Holden. Various people have talked a lot at Holden about a Greek notion of a person being made up of two parts, body, which is bad, and soul, which is good. Don't have to elaborate on that too much. Plato laid that out in classic form in his Doctrine of the Immortality of the Soul. He called the body the prison house of the soul. The soul is unfortunately incarcerated in the body. The body comes from matter, which is essentially and intrinsically evil. The soul comes from God and spirit, which is essentially intrinsically good. I'll just state that. That can be elaborated on at great length. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit on Friday in connection with the doctrine of the resurrection of the body in chapter 15. But that was a very, very common notion among the Greeks. The body is bad, the soul is good. Okay, how does that work out then ethically? You can work it out either way, and as a matter of fact, people did work it out either way. There were people who said, the body is the prison house of the soul. The soul is good, the body is bad. How best to demonstrate my spirituality than to demonstrate that I know how bad the body really is? And with all those sacred prostitutes up on the Acro Corinth, and with a brothel on every corner in Corinth, and with a lot of people who want to live it up, well, why not? And in doing so, I will prove that I only care about the soul and the spirit. And I'm a very spiritual person because I don't care what I do with my body. There were people who did that, and they were called libertines. Huh? You can go that route. There were other people in the congregation who started from the same premise, body is bad and soul is good, but who went the opposite route ethically and said, how am I going to demonstrate what a spiritual person I am? I'll demonstrate what a spiritual person I am by rejecting the body, by suppressing the body, by having nothing to do with anything that smacks of sensuality, whether that's eating or drinking or lovemaking or anything else. And these people were the ascetics, A-S-C-E-T-I-C-S. So you had those Greek people who were on the one hand libertines, on the other hand ascetics, and they were in the congregation. They were Christians, but they carried that baggage along with them. There were Jews in the congregation who had become Christians, who carried along with them the
the Jewish notion that it is an obligation to be married and have children. I mean, it's wrong to be single, and it's wrong not to have children because the Messiah has not come, and even though they believed the Messiah had come, they carried with that there's a cultural lag there, and they said, you must have children. There were other Jews who said, no, the Messiah has come, and that means that you don't have to have children. So intercourse is not a necessary function. There were also people in that congregation who said that sexual intercourse and those kinds of bodily things are necessarily evil. Therefore, if you're married and you become a Christian, obviously you should divorce your wife or husband and get out of that situation where you're going to be lovemaking all the time, because that's wrong. These were ascetic people. There were other ascetics who said, well, maybe you ought not to get divorced, but for goodness sake, get twin beds like this afternoon. And there were actually people who did that, who said, it's all right to be married, but for goodness sakes, don't ever sleep together. So the horribly complex mess of sexual ethics in that congregation at Corinth, and they write to Paul, and they say, okay, who's right? See? Just like they want to know who's right, Apollos or Cephas or Paul or we who belong to Christ. So they are, who's right? And Paul's problem all the way through 1 Corinthians is that they ask him an ethical question. They want to know who's right, and Paul responds and says, well, it isn't like that. You're asking the wrong question. Okay. Let's look at the text, chapter 7, 1 Corinthians. Now, I think that the first thing to acknowledge is that he does say some rather negative things. There's no question about that. And let's just point to a few of them. You know them well. Verse 7, I wish that all were as I myself am. Paul is undoubtedly single. I mean, without question, I think in this case single. Whether he's a widower or not, we don't know for sure. But I wish that all were as myself am. Okay. Verse 8, to the unmarried and the widows, I say it is well for them to remain single as I do. Pretty clear statement. Or in verse 27... the last part of verse 27, he says, are you free from a wife? Don't get married. Pretty clear. Verse 32 and on, I want you to be free from anxiety. The unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife. Well, I'm not exactly sure whether that's entirely the case, but... and his interests are divided. The unmarried woman or girl is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit, but the married woman is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please her husband. I say this for your benefit, and so on. Okay. Verse 38, in the last part of that, he who refrains from marriage will do better. And verse 40, but in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as he is. Okay, those statements are there. No question about that. But that's not all that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. So let's go back to the beginning. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote. And we have to say a word here about the New Testament manuscripts. Prior to the invention of the printing press, there was, of course, no such thing as quotation marks. In fact, in the earliest New Testament manuscripts, they don't distinguish between small letters and capital letters, and there are no spaces between words, and there's no punctuation. So all the punctuation, all of the sentence cutting off that you find in the Bible is an editor's decision. That doesn't occur in the Greek manuscripts. And anytime you find quotation marks in the text, that's an editor's decision. There's no need for that before copyright laws, right? There's no such thing as quotation marks until the invention of movable type. So anytime you see quotation marks, that's an editor's decision. And anytime you don't see quotation marks. That's an editor's decision, too. I'm disagreeing with the editors now, not with God, but with the editors of the text. And chapter 7, verse 1, I think that it's unfortunate that they didn't put quotation marks around "it is well for a man not to touch a woman." Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, colon, quote, "it is well for a man not to touch a woman," period, end quote. That's a, Paul's responding to the letter. He's responding to this particular part of that letter. And they write to him, they say, "as well for a man not to touch a woman." That's the ascetic party coming out. Paul says, okay, now we'll talk about that. So that's in quotes. Now, verse 2. "Because of the temptation to immorality, each man should have his own wife." It's an imperative. Pretty strong statement. Each woman should have her own husband. Now that's an interesting thing that's often overlooked, it seems to me, in 1 Corinthians 7, is that there is a very nice parallel that what Paul says about the man, he says about the woman. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. That's not an option. You ascetic birds are off the track. Sell your double beds and come on. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise, the wife should give conjugal rights to her husband. Again, there's a parallel. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, likewise, the wife to her husband. We can't be tired all the time, right? The wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not rule over his own body, but the wife does. I mean, that's really something in his time, huh? That double parallel structure, that's really amazing. "Do not refuse one another." That's pretty strong language. Except perhaps agreement for a season. All right, you want to pray? All right, and pray, that's all right. But then come together again, for goodness sakes. "Lest Satan tempt you through your lack of self-control. I say this by way of concession." What is the antecedent of the pronoun "this"? Let's see. Is the antecedent that you can come together again? Or is the antecedent that it's all right for a time, if you want to pray for a while, not to come together? I say, in the context of that whole passage, the concession is, if you want to pray for a while, okay. I'll make that concession. You can abstain for a little while. That's the antecedent. But then come together again. Okay, the point is that Paul is very careful throughout this whole letter not to get caught on the horns of an ethical dilemma. They want to know who's right, the ascetics or the libertine. Paul says, no, it isn't like that. So he does say some things like, "I think, if you're asking me, I'd remain single." But there is no way that Paul can be called an ascetic. And joining that party, it seems to me, he has a massive commitment to human sexuality and the expression of that within the marriage relationship. Okay, now, why is it that he does say those things that he says? And it seems to me that the word is quite clear in verse 26. Where Paul says, in view of the impending distress, in verse 29, the appointed time has grown very short. In verse 31, for the form of this world is passing away. That is, Paul is thoroughly drenched in an eschatological perspective. Eschatology means the doctrine or talk about the last things. And Paul is thoroughly drenched in, if you wish, the hope of God's wrapping up of his redemptive purpose with his world. And he, like most people in the early church, think that that's going to come about rather quickly. And it's not just in 1 Corinthians 7. If you want to look at some quick passages, chapter 1, verse 7, he says, so that you are not lacking in any spiritual gift as you wait for the revealing of our Lord Jesus Christ, who will sustain you to the end, guiltless in the day of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's an eschatological passage. Chapter 3, verse 13. Each man's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it. The day of the Lord. That's the end day. Chapter 10, verse 11. He says, now these things happened to them as a warning, but they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages has come. Chapter 13, he says, now we see in a mirror, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully. Chapter 15 is all about the resurrection of the dead. But Paul has a thoroughly eschatological outlook. He's impregnated by that hope. He thinks it's going to happen very, very soon. And that perspective filters back into his attitude toward things. And Paul says, for goodness sakes, it's not that it's wrong to get married and to have intercourse with one another. It's right to do that. But we are living in a time when the end is going to come very soon. And as a matter of fact, those kinds of obligations to live in families and to reproduce and all of those things can be looked at in a different light, because it looks to me as though the thing isn't going to last that long. And so it doesn't make all kinds of sense, if you're asking me, to get involved in those kinds of relationships. But if anybody misunderstands them, he's very, very quick to set them straight. For instance, in verse 27, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Don't seek marriage. If you marry, you don't sin. If a girl marries, she doesn't sin. It's okay. Don't misunderstand me. Verse 36. If anyone thinks that he's not behaving properly toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong and it has, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. That's not wrong. It's right. That's fine. If you're asking me, I think, well, in view of the impending distress, the form of this world is passing away, I don't think it makes a lot of sense, but for goodness sakes, don't think there's something wrong with that. Huh? Okay, so Paul has an eschatological point of view, and the question is, of course, it didn't happen as soon as he thought it would happen, and so 20 centuries later, what is the significance for us of that? And it would seem to me that there is a kind of intrinsicness about the eschatological hope. That is, the church always lives in the expectation of the end. We confess in the Apostles' Creed, from whence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. And that does feed back into our decisions and our attitudes and our perspectives. But these 20 centuries have gone by, and it seems to me that qualifies a little bit what Paul says in terms of his kind of personal advice, but I think it does not qualify the perspective, the attitude that Paul has. And I think that that can be spelled out rather nicely by this passage that I read at breakfast, where Paul says, verse 29, I mean, brethren, the appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none. Let those who mourn live as though they were not mourning. Let those who rejoice live as though they were not rejoicing. Let those who buy live as though they had no goods. and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. Now, it's very important that Paul doesn't say, in this case, don't be married, don't live in the world, don't rejoice, don't mourn, don't buy. He says, buy as though you didn't buy. Mourn as though you didn't mourn. Rejoice as though you didn't mourn. Be married as though you didn't. Weren't married. As though not. The Greek words are hos me. That means hang loose. Chapter 5, when he's talking about this guy sleeping with his father's wife, there's a similar passage where he says in verse 9, chapter 5, I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral man, not at all meaning the immoral of this world, or the greedy, or the robbers, or the idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. That would be ridiculous. Of course you live in the world. Or Jesus' high priestly prayer in John 16 is really a neat passage in this regard, the last verse of 16 and on into 17. Last verse of John 16, he says, in the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Live as though not. Or in verse 15 of chapter 17 of John, I do not pray that thou shouldst take them out of the world, that would be ridiculous, but that thou shouldst keep them from the evil one. What Jesus Christ does is not to take us out of the world, but to keep us from the evil one, so that there is, our problem is not that we are in the world, our problem is not that we have bodies, our problem is not that we live in the material world, our problem is that we are sought about by the devil as a roaring lion, seeing whom he may devour. That is, our problem is evil, our problem is sin, our problem is not matter. So that what that perspective does is to say, there is something which is ultimate, namely, God and his purpose for his world. That means that you can hang loose with the penultimate. You focus on the last things and the things before the last. You have all kinds of freedom about it. You want to get married? All right. You don't get married? It's all right. It's okay. If you ask me personally, well, I'd say no. But hold it. It's all right. You can, there is something that's absolute, and that's God and his purpose for his world. Well, everything else is relative. The problem is that we relativize the absolute and absolutize the relative, and we get all fouled up about that. So Paul's response is that because we are people who are committed to God, who is working out his way with his world, one thing that we can have more than anyone else has a sense of humor. You can really hang loose. You can really laugh about it. And it seems to me that some people that I've come in contact with who have a terrible time in their marriage, sometimes, I have to qualify that all over the place, sometimes have a big problem because they take themselves and their marriage too blasted seriously. I mean, that's not the ultimate. God and his purpose in his world is the ultimate, and you can hang loose. There are a lot of things that you can take quite lightly if you take the one needful thing seriously. Okay, so it's an eschatological response. It's a hang loose response. One more quickie. I would say that one way of characterizing Paul's response is that it is a vocational response, and I'm using that word vocation in its theological sense, vocatio, or calling. My calling is to be a Christian. My occupation is to teach school, in a theological sense. And it's very unfortunate that those words have somehow been switched around. One more quickie. I would say that one way of characterizing Paul's response is that it is a vocational response,
And I'm using that word vocation in a theological sense, vocatio, or calling. My calling is to be a Christian. My occupation is to teach school, in a theological sense. And it's very unfortunate that those words have somehow been switched around. But vocation or calling, we talked about that yesterday. Consider your call, brethren. Not many of you were wise, but God called, God chose. Ecclesia, the church is those, the called out ones. We talked a great deal about that yesterday. Well, here it wraps up again in chapter 7. Verse 17, only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him, and in which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? All right. Don't try to change that. I mean, there were people who did that. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? All right. Don't seek circumcision. Neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. Everyone should remain the state in which he was called. Were you a slave? Never mind. If you gain your freedom, great, great. But I mean, that's penultimate. It's not ultimate. He was called in the Lord as a slave, as a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he was free, was called as a slave of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. So, brethren, in whatever state each was called, let him remain with God. I just looked at a commentary this morning which headed up this section with the phrase, maintaining the status quo. I don't think so. It doesn't say that. What it says is there's a difference between something that's absolute and something that's relative. Now, obviously, that can be misread, and if you want to, you can get a whole justification for apartheid, I suppose, out of a passage like that. It seems to me that's really a perverse reading of the text. Paul is saying, look, you people in this congregation are obsessed with questions of morality, and you want to know who's right. The people who are getting married, the people who are not getting married, the people who are divorcing, the people who are not divorcing. Paul says, hold it, that's not the question. The question is, do you believe in the living God who's at work in his world and who's going to get his job done? If you do, then you can stay where you are. If you want to get married, it's all right. If you want to, it's no big deal. But you can be a Christian where you are. Anywhere you are. There is no place and there is no time which is irredeemable. You can be a Christian wherever you are. And that's a great Reformation doctrine of vocation, of course. And so I guess I really have difficulty seeing Paul as the world's all-time champion male chauvinist pig. I really don't think that's the sum and substance of chapter 7. He tries very, very hard not to get caught by teaming up with any of these parties. What he does is try to redirect their vision and redirect their perspective and then say, all right, now if you really know what counts, then you can hang loose. And you can make any number of decisions in those realms if you want. Well, that's something about chapter 7. What would you like to say?
In chapter 9, verse 5, it kind of leads you to believe that he may have been married or had a wife. Mm-hmm.
9:5. Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a wife? Well, you could certainly read that. The stuff that I've read on this question usually centers around the question of the Sanhedrin. And Paul, if Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin, apparently he was. There are people who say it was obligatory for members of the Sanhedrin to be married, and they conclude from that that Paul was a widower. And I think that at the particular time, I've read enough stuff on each side of that question so that I don't have a strong opinion on it. Well, but it's interesting. But I maybe someone else does, but I really don't. I think you could read 9:5 that way, but it's not a very tight argument.
What did you say about the ordination of women?
Ordination of women.
Let me just say very briefly, Merv, because I spent some time on that in the session in which some people were there, that the argument at the present time, the official argument of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and that's the only context that I know very well, says that in Ephesians, Paul says that the man is the head of the woman. Husband is the head of the wife. And headship, they take to mean authority. They distinguish between ministry and the ministry. Ministry is, in general, the ministry is ordained ministry. And they interpret the ministry in terms of authority. They say that it is an order of creation. It's not a situational thing, but an order of creation that the man is the head of the woman. Therefore, you cannot ordain women, because that would mean that a woman would be authority over men in the congregation, and that would be contrary to the orders of creation that God has built into the world. In the document from the American Lutheran Church with which I'm most familiar, we say that the orders of creation, that's a phrase that is that develops in the life of the church. It's not a biblical term. The orders of creation are not permanent rubber bands holding the world together, but are ways in which the church says that God's desire is for order and not chaos, but that God works obviously with different orders at different times, different political structures, and so on. And furthermore, that it is not strange that Paul works in a context in which women are, in general, thought to be inferior to men. That's not strange. I mean, that was true of the time in which he lived. The amazing thing is how he crashes through those structures and says, in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, male or female. And it's precisely as a result of Paul's breaking through those first century notions about women that we've come to this point, at this time and this place, that that the liberation of women has at least begun to be a reality. And so that's kind of the argument.
Yeah. Yeah. The Lord must be pulling his hair out that we're nitpicking, huh? On this business of women and man. I mean, today in 19, why must we be so precise with our terms with this business? I mean, women, I'm LCA, so we're poor.
I mean, one person's nitpicking, you know, is another person's scholarly research or something like that. I think that I respect Lutheran Church Missouri Synod for being very, very serious about attempting to get signals from the scriptures. I disagree with the signals that they get, but I my argument is, you know, let's sit down with the scriptures and talk on the basis of the word. And if that involves, you know, some rather tight and technical talk, nitpicking if you wish, so be it. But I'm not going to argue on a question like that or anything else in thin air. I'm going to argue on the basis of the scriptures, and I think that does involve some rather careful work. So, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to pick a nit. Let's just say that even if a man were to be over his wife, okay, I still don't see how they get the assumption that any other man would be over my wife. There would be a difference between a wife and a woman. And so, and Paul says you don't have to be married, so there must be a situation of a woman over whom there is no man, unless you assume that every man is over every woman.
I would doubt very much that there would be anybody here who would disagree with that. But I think it's important to understand what the argument is, and the argument has to do with the orders of creation. And orders of creation is a phrase which is generally used to mean the state, the family, the church.
Yep.
And orders of creation are something which are not changeable, and they do, I think incorrectly, I agree with you, they do take the headship notion as an order of creation, not just in a marriage relationship, but in terms of man and woman.
Now, I don't know where they would get that. Other than every woman had to be married, But Paul says you don't.
Yeah. Well, they take it that way. Yes. Yeah.
And the ALC and LCA agrees that that the ministry is supposed to be authority over other people.
No, that's
so
another
it's the interpretation of the
right.
Ministry.
That's another basis of disagreement. We would not be inclined to distinguish as sharply between ministry and the ministry, and we would see ministry essentially as servanthood rather than as authority. So there are differences all along the line on that question.
Why is it that the ALC, I think you said before, changed their mind about divorced pastors
not kicking out anymore? Why did it change now actually towards the divorced pastor in the state ministry? Yeah. All right. Well, that's a big one because the words, of course, are rather strong, you know, as you know. And they go back to the words of Jesus, which are recorded in the Gospels. In Mark and in Luke, the statement on divorce is very sharp, that to marry a divorced woman is to make her an adulterer or something like that. In Matthew, there is a little escape clause in there. Whoever divorces his wife, comma, except on grounds of unchastity, comma. And there are a number of ways of handling that. You could, of course, say Jesus said one thing one time and another thing another time. I think it's more likely that that the word of Jesus was originally unqualified, but as the church lived with that word, it found out that it had to live with that word in the concrete situations of a messed up world, and so someone in copying a manuscript put in there, comma, except on grounds of unchastity, that worked its way into the text, and so in the Matthean version of the gospel we have that exception. That would seem to indicate that there are other possibilities maybe of exceptions. And I think that maybe, as I would tend to see it, we have become more and more sensitized to the fact that sin is not simply an individualistic thing. It is not just that I, as an individual, do bad things, but sin is something that pervades and permeates and distorts all of the whole creation, and certainly societal structures. And that there are not nice, clean options most of the time. And so when a situation arises where it's let's say wrong, or let's say extremely difficult, or let's say living hell or something, to remain married, and it's wrong to be divorced, then you're juggling not a right and a wrong, but you're juggling two bad options. And you begin to weigh those. And I think that most of the church would tend to say, okay, there are times when divorce, wrong as it is, I think that's really bad to say divorce is great. Wrong as it is, may be the better of two options. Then you take a divorced person, well, what does that mean then? That's true, the word is there about not being remarried. As the church lives with that thing, in the context of the forgiveness of sins, in the context of God's picking up the mess and making something of it, in the context of God redeeming times and places, is remarriage always wrong
or the more wrong of two options. Huh? So I think that that's the reason, and there are certainly differences of opinion about that. I have some colleagues who say, okay, you can rationalize all you want, there's the text. Huh? But I think that the majority of people that I work with in the church would say it's one of those very, very agonizing things in which we are at the same time sinner and justified, and decisions have to be made in the light of the best information that we can that we can put together, and in the context of the grace and forgiveness of God.
But other people would say too that it isn't just a matter of being a Christian. You could be a Christian, you know. But when you come to a pastor, do you expect a little bit more? Do you set a little higher standard? You do something or other, you know.
Okay, right. So that the question was specifically about divorced pastors, right. Okay.
So then a homosexual will come and you'll say, yes, you can be a Christian, or you'll be a child, you can be also, you know.
Okay.
Okay,
and I think that's a serious dimension of the problem. In other words, it would be quite possible to come to the conclusion that that the church may be quite able to embrace a wide variety of divorce and remarriage, but yet might make the decision that for the clergy, not because the clergy is divine or something like this, but a kind of prudential decision about it, that it would be better not to have people who are divorced and remarried in the ordained ministry. I think, for instance, when you talk about homosexuality, that's a little bit that's something in which I have a stronger opinion. I think that certainly there's all kinds of clinical data that's revising our notions about homosexuality, and maybe we have to revise our notions about whether or not or how appropriate it is for a homosexual to be a member of St. John's by the Gas Pump or something like this. I still feel that regardless of what decision we might make about that, I think that the hazards and what is latent and what is practicing, you know, but the hazards of a practicing homosexual in the ordained ministry are so massive.
Like what?
That, pardon me?
Like what?
Oh man, a lot. Yeah.
I think perhaps the young lady wouldn't realize. I'm going to tell you what one would be in the ministry and find out what the hazards are. That would get you off the hook.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know how close you've been to the gay liberation movement, but that's a pretty big revolution, you know, that's going on right now, and there are the spin-offs of that thing with relation to family structure, with relation to promiscuity, with relation to, I mean, you talk for one very practical thing, the rise of venereal disease, you know, is absolutely, I mean, it's an epidemic. It is absolutely, that's something we all really ought to be scared out of our livers about. And very little talk about that by the people, for instance, at Research East at the University of Minnesota, who are saying if you aren't having intercourse up one end of the block and down the other, you've got all kinds of Puritan hang-ups.
Okay.
They aren't interested. And so I'm just saying that there are, it's an incredibly complex question. And it seems to me that
That's why I say the hazards are massive.
Yeah, but how are the hazards different having them in the clergy than in the congregation? Is it right to have a double standard?
I think it depends on what you mean by a double standard. I think that there is, that's very tricky, but let's take another example. Let's take an alcoholic. I don't have any problem whatsoever with alcoholics as members of Christian congregations. When I was in the parish, I went every Monday night to AA with a member of the congregation. I mean, there's no problem about that, but you get an alcoholic, I would say the same thing, you know, for, let's say, president of Dean's Milk Company in Crookston or something like that. I think it's, you know, the milk company doesn't function very well if you have an alcoholic, you know, in the president's chair. I think it's true that the church is not well served if we place alcoholics in the ordained ministry. And I think it's very, very difficult for practicing homosexuality in our society. Maybe, you know, who knows, 25 years from now. But in our society at the present time, I think it's very, very difficult for a practicing homosexual to be an appropriate servant of word and sacrament.
I understand your distinctions about alcoholics and divorced men, but I still don't. I still can't quite see what. Maybe it's naivete, but I'm not exactly sure what the massive hazards are that you're talking about.
One of my classmates, for instance, was murdered. One of my seminary classmates was murdered and left lying along the highway after picking up a liaison or contact or whatever you want in a bar 15 miles away from his parish. There are lots of hazards.
There are lots of hazards to straight life, too.
Sure.
So you're saying that
sure.
Homosexuality is wrong.
Yeah. All right. Maybe we have to, you know, to save that one. The question had to do, you know, with ordination. I don't know what I think on that question. I'm not ready yet to say. I'm not ready yet to say that homosexuality is just great. I really am not. I think that we talked about this a little bit the other day on situation ethics. It seems to me that we cannot only ask the question of act, we have to ask the question of being. We have to ask the question, what is it to be human? We have to ask the question of continuities. And whether it is really the case that the variety of God's creation somehow or another appropriately designates some people bisexual, some people homosexual, etc. I don't have enough data in my hands yet to make. Maybe there are obviously people here who've come to a firm conclusion on that question one way or the other. I just simply have to say I've not. I've got to have more stuff to work with. But I am not ready at the moment to jump on the gay liberation bandwagon. Now I think maybe we'll take like two more comments and we better quit because there are sessions beginning at 10:30 and there's coffee. Let's take yours and Betsy and
the I was going to say, you have to get into the different types of homosexuality, and I need to use the word type, but if you know, someone who has a good friend they live with, that's one thing, but if it's someone whose mission in the world is to love everybody, whether heterosexually or homosexually, I can see some real problems involved in what is open brotherhood? What does that mean? Yeah. That we all love? I can see some real problems.
There are let's say not a few pastors who are notoriously promiscuous with organists and secretaries, etc. And I would have the same, you know, I'm not baptizing those people either. Huh? I think they're, okay, Betsy?
I was just going to say something along that line. I saw a TV program in England that made a point to me that I hadn't exactly thought about it before, which is the difference between a homosexual relationship and the thought that we often attribute promiscuity to homosexuals. And it was a woman who was a principal of girls, no, the mixed school, and she said that she was a lesbian, she was living with another woman, and that she was afraid to say this because, I mean, oh my gosh, you know, she's a Muslim. And her point was, what's the difference between that and a married man who could get involved just as well with a girl in my school?
Mm-hmm.
And she was a woman committed to one other woman,
mm-hmm.
which maybe this is nice, but that made a point to me. I had thought about, you immediately brought up, boy, venereal disease, and that says a homosexual is a promiscuous person, and the only thing I brought up was that he need not be.
Yes, I think that, all right.
Just a little point. I'm not against your premise.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.